Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. Did you all have a good time celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day earlier this week? We'd like to acknowledge that here at the Sit Still Studio, we are recording on the land of the Peoria, Kickapoo, and Potawatomi Nations. In other parts of the country, the holiday on Monday celebrates some guy that thought he discovered America in 1492. It's like, dude, do you even realize that people were there so much longer before you sailed three random ships across the ocean blue? Ugh, how Eurocentric. We've got another excellent show in store for you all today. We'll start with this week's top headlines. Then we'll examine the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then we'll round out the show with our interview with high school teacher Caroline English. This fall weather has got me itching for a warm apple cider beverage. So grab your cup of cheer and let's get started. Up next, this week's headlines. On Monday, Republicans were caught committing voter fraud by setting up fake voter drop boxes in California. Republicans admitted to the crime immediately, quickly adding, "And we would have gotten away with it too, if it weren't for those meddling officials." The biggest news of this week was Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing, which, despite massive public objection, is going to happen whether you like it or not, making Amy Barrett the YouTube advertisement of the Supreme Court. During the confirmation, Barrett avoided answers to questions on abortion, whether she thought climate change was real, and whether she would support a peaceful transition of power. She was better at dodging the description of her job than Trump was at dodging Vietnam. Senator Ted Cruz asked possibly the hardest-hitting questions of all, including if ACB spoke French and if she played the piano. Who knew the hearings were actually an admissions interview for an all-girls New England boarding school? Last night, we were supposed to witness the town hall-style presidential debate, but instead, we saw a Biden special on ABC and basically a Trump rally on NBC. These separate events were definitely not what we asked for, but the thing that got me down the most is that NBC cut a deal with Trump. "You've always been there for me when I really needed you, and now you hit me with this? I expected better from you. You're the network of The Good Place, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, heck, even Saturday Night Live. We know Trump says he's the president of law and order, but you know he would be one of the criminals on an episode of SVU. It's clear you're in it for the ratings, but a Trump town hall? You sound more desperate than Quibi." I guess the only way to make it up to us would be if you picked up Sit Still, Look Opinionated as your next up-and-coming late-night show. I think it's only fair. Mike and I will be awaiting our offer letters. You can email them to us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And that was this week's headlines. This week's episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated is brought to you by Theater in the Dark, A War of the Worlds, a virtual audio drama. A link to tickets will be listed in the show notes.
No one would have believed.
You see this? What's happening in the suburbs?
In the first years of the 21st century.
Wi-Fi's not working.
That this world was being watched keenly and closely.
What's happening?
By intelligences greater than our own.
That's in Kankakee. We should drive out and see it.
Careful. Don't get too close.
Dr. Pearson, have there been fresh attempts to signal these beings?
This October.
It's something more than a meteorite.
Theater in the Dark presents...
It's a cylinder.
And it's opening.
A war of the worlds. A virtual audio drama performed live every night over Zoom. Pay what you can tickets available now at theaterinthedark.com.
Next, this week's deep dive. So, the notorious RBG. Her loss has left us all wondering, is our one last shred of democracy gone? As if this country hasn't already been through enough this year. Ruth Bader Ginsburg most definitely made a striking impact on not only American laws and policy, but also became somewhat of an iconic figure. And we'll delve more into that later in the episode. To understand why she became such an iconic figure, let's take a look at some key moments in her life and how they shaped her legacy. Quick disclaimer here, this is just an introduction to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life. As much as I think it would be fun to write an entire biography, ain't nobody got time for that. So instead, we're going to focus on a few key moments in her career and personal life. Remember, she lived to be 87 years old. Let's start at the beginning, shall we? Ruth Bader was born on March 15, 1933 in Brooklyn, New York. Her father was an immigrant from Ukraine, and her mother was born in the U.S. to Polish immigrants. RBG was known to describe her family as focused on education with an emphasis on discipline. Ginsburg had a strong relationship with her mother, and sadly, her mother passed away when Ginsburg was 17. Although her mother died quite early in Ginsburg's life, she credits her mother for ingraining in her the stoicism and public absence of emotion that she was known for throughout her life. For undergrad, RBG attended Cornell, where she met her beloved husband, Marty Ginsburg. They married shortly after RBG graduated, and they both went on to attend Harvard Law School. During this time, Marty was diagnosed with cancer and had to undergo radiation therapy. Thankfully, Marty recovered and was able to finish his time at Harvard and secure a position at a law firm in New York City. With this new job, RBG transferred to Columbia Law School and finished out her graduate degree. Now, in her early career, RBG faced challenges in landing a job, mostly due to her pre-existing condition of being a woman. In light of that, she secured a position at Rutgers University teaching law and eventually became the first tenured woman. She taught classes on gender law, and in 1970, wrote the first casebook on sex discrimination, which prompted the ACLU to approach her to co-fund the Women's Rights Project. What's the Women's Rights Project, you might ask? It was a program that focused on incremental cases that demonstrated that discrimination towards a class of citizens, in this case women, was in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Ginsburg's goal with this project was to choose cases that would establish precedent and induce long-term change. Her work with the ACLU and the Women's Rights Project helped her gain national attention. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter nominated Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the D.C. Court of Appeals, and she was quickly confirmed by the Senate. During this time, she not only championed liberal ideals in the courts, but sought to compromise with her circuit court peers Antonin Scalia and Robert Bork. After her work in the circuit courts, President Bill Clinton nominated RBG to the Supreme Court on June 22, 1993. Her nomination came with a bit of controversy. Dun dun da! As Clinton had originally hoped to nominate Governor Mario Cuomo. Her nomination hearings came with their own controversies as well. She spoke in detail about her position on abortion, yet she refused to answer any questions about the death penalty. Nor did she respond to questions about her lack of hiring any Black Americans as clerks or secretaries during her time on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Despite these questions, Republicans and Democrats lauded Ruth Bader Ginsburg's work and confirmed her to the Supreme Court. She was the second woman to serve as a Supreme Court justice after Sandra Day O'Connor. Ginsburg's first stance on the bench was to be a moderate voice, who was willing to compromise with her peers. Yet with the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor and the appointment of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito, it became increasingly difficult for RBG to compromise. From the early 2000s on, she began expressing her dissenting opinions. Her most notable dissents include Bush v. Gore in 2000, in which she dissented against George W. Bush winning the presidency, Ledbetter v. Goodyear in 2007, in which she showcased the disparity in payment was due to gender discrimination, and Shelby County versus Holder in 2013, in which she dissented against Chief Justice Roberts' opinion that things have changed, and therefore protection of equal rights on account of race was no longer necessary. This quote shows exactly what she meant. Throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. Then, after multiple battles with cancer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away on September 18th of this year. If you're listening to this episode, RBG's death probably hit you pretty hard. We have definitely felt a shift in the country, and that's why we created this episode for you, dear listener. So that's RBG's background. But aside from her being a historical figure, why is there so much controversy surrounding her seat on the Supreme Court? Well, if you remember our episode on the judicial branch of the government, the Supreme Court is the ultimate authority when it comes to deciding the fate of the laws in America. It has the final say over things that can massively impact the lives of Americans. It was the deciding factor for Bush winning the presidency, for giving women the right to choose, and for ending segregation in schools, just to name a few. The idea is that justices on the Supreme Court should look at each case with unparalleled objectivity, an idea that seems to go against human nature. Because, as we've seen over the past few decades, each party has become more and more partisan and unyielding to compromise. Especially when you take into account that presidents are the ones who nominate which justices should serve. As a reminder, the Senate is responsible for confirming or denying each appointment. If political parties are following the trend of becoming more partisan, and every transition of power leads to more extreme legislation tilting to one side, then the idea is that the party in power needs to secure as much control over the institutions to stop their respective change from being undone. So, how does this translate to now? Well, in 2016, Antonin Scalia, a conservative-leaning judge, died. As is the role of the president, Barack Obama nominated Merrick Garland. However, at that time, the Senate was controlled by a Republican majority, who then pulled an unusual and highly controversial move. Within hours of Antonin Scalia dying, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell publicly announced that he would block Obama's nominee and refused to even have a confirmation hearing for Garland. He justified this move by saying it was not right to appoint a justice during an election year, and that the next justice should be appointed by whoever the American people vote for in the next election, even though that election was 11 months away. Of course, as we all know, Donald Trump was elected president. Within the first month of his presidency, Trump nominated Neil Gorsuch, a very right-leaning justice to the court. This then gave the Republican Party a 5-4 majority on the court. In 2018, Trump nominated Brett Kavanaugh to fill the vacant seat left by Justice Kennedy, another controversial nomination, not only because of the process, but also because of the candidate himself. Kavanaugh was thought to have been nominated because of his views on presidential power and immunity. His nomination also coincided with the investigation into Trump's ties with Russia. Kavanaugh had several accusations of sexual assault levied at him, and displayed historically unprofessional behavior during his confirmation hearing in the Senate. For the record, I'd like to point out that a child wouldn't be granted the right to desert if they acted like that, let alone having the deciding power over the lives of Americans. But that brings us to 2020. Just last month, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and within hours of her death, Mitch McConnell said that it was his responsibility to fill the seat before the next presidential election, completely contradicting his argument in 2016, where he said that 11 months out from election was too soon to nominate a new judge. Not only is Election Day less than a month away, 9 million votes have already been cast, putting us squarely in the middle of an ongoing election, proving Mitch McConnell doesn't give a shit about precedent, decorum, or fairness. I say Mitch McConnell, but this more accurately represents the viewpoints of the entirety of the Republican Party, who have had no qualms in supporting the contradicting views based on how it best serves them. Despite even having senators like Lindsey Graham quoted as saying, "I want you to use my words against me," back in 2016. Now, I would like to point out that there are no laws stating that a Supreme Court justice cannot be nominated during an election year. It just truly highlights the hypocrisy of Republicans as they desperately try to maintain their hold on power. Yet another demonstration on how tactics such as gerrymandering, voter suppression, misinformation, and low voter turnout has allowed America to be held hostage by a party that has for a long time now represented the minority in this country. With the confirmation of another justice, Republicans would then gain a 6-3 majority in the courts, a move that they are banking on using so that Donald Trump can contest the results of an unfavorable election. Just to be clear, if and when Donald Trump loses this November, he's going to claim that voting by mail has caused massive voter fraud. And just like Gore versus Bush, this will be a case that will be presented in front of the Supreme Court. Donald Trump has used misinformation to try and undermine the legitimacy of our voting system. He is attempting to suppress the vote by encouraging his supporters to unlawfully monitor polling places for illegal activity and greenlighting efforts to sabotage the U.S. mail system to discourage voters from voting by mail. Additionally, he has refused to say that he would accept defeat in any election or commit to any peaceful transition of power. Let us be clear here. The allegations of voter fraud have been categorically and routinely denounced as false, incorrect on all accounts, by institutions, by high-level journalism, by credible and respectable individuals. Donald Trump and the Republican Party are trying to steal this election. In the meantime, it seems as if it is inevitable that Republicans will push through another justice. Even with an increasing number of Republican senators catching the coronavirus, there have been reports of, quote, wheeling in senators who are sick just so they can push through the vote prior to the election. Again, another example of how Republicans are willing to put others at risk to further their agenda. The candidate which they are currently attempting to push through is Amy Coney Barrett. Amy Barrett is a conservative-leaning judge who is known for her intelligence and high standing in the academic community, something that is easy to overlook with the climate of persecution from either side nowadays. However, Democrats' fears are not unfounded. Like Antonin Scalia, she described herself as an originalist, meaning she interprets the Constitution how the founders would have intended, something critics have said does not account for changing times. Barrett's links to a dedicated Christian group have led to continued criticism and fear that her religious leanings would directly impact her rulings. There has even been speculation that the religious group she is a part of was a direct inspiration for Hulu's Handmaid's Tale. While the author has not pointed to any particular group as inspiration, I will say that, in this religious group, they do refer to women as handmaids, a role that Barrett herself did undertake. Barrett has publicly stated that her religious ideologies would not affect her work. But again, she was a handmaid, so... Nonetheless, with her religious group's public statements about life starting at the point of creation and sexual consent being only between a man and a woman, many are fearful that her nomination will lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, as well as the erosion of LGBTQIA+ rights. The other thing on the table is that with this nomination, it sets Trump in a perfect position to finally get the votes to do away with the Affordable Care Act, something he has promised to do since his campaign in 2016. Trump has still not presented a plan that would replace Obamacare if repealed, and though he has made public claims saying that he would not strip healthcare for those with pre-existing conditions, a quick fact check will conclude that nothing he has done, or plans to do, indicates what he has said. The move will likely leave 25 million Americans without healthcare. So, that's what's at stake. The last question we are left with is, if Democrats win the White House and also are able to flip the Senate, what will happen from there? Well, a lot of institutional change. An article from The Atlantic summed it up quite nicely. They will aim to fundamentally change how voting and government work in the United States by expanding voting rights, reducing the influence of money in politics, strengthening ethics rules, and maybe even ending the Senate filibuster. Reforms they hope will make America's democracy work better and the rest of their agenda easier to carry out. So, how does that affect the Supreme Court? Well, there are a few strategies that Democrats are considering. One would be to eliminate lifetime appointments, making justices more accurately represent the views of changing times. It wouldn't be the 2 to 6 year term limits that Congress goes through, which could lead to rapid shifts in the court, but rather 18-year term limits, adding a tiny bit more accountability to a position that has virtually none. Two, to establish statehood for Puerto Rico and DC. By doing this, it would add 4 more senators to the Senate, with the high possibility of all 4 senators being Democrats. It would also give representation to Americans who currently have none. And 3, the option to expand the Supreme Court. Expanding the number of justices on the court from 9 to 15 would balance out the court and take away the Republican stronghold. There's nothing in the Constitution that limits the number of justices who serve, and so would be completely in the right for such a move to be made. The question to follow that would be, where does this end? The answer is, we don't know. Packing the court is a last resort that has been brought up to counter Republicans' refusal to honor precedents set by their own party, as well as a response to decades of cheap and deceitful tactics of obstruction. Joe Biden has long opposed the idea of expanding the Supreme Court, although recent news has brought attention to his refusal to comment on if he would expand the court or not, once winning the election, which is understandable. While he opposes expanding the Supreme Court personally, it is an idea that is quickly gathering steam on the left, and denouncing it could lead to the loss of support from his base. Whereas owning and admitting to embracing the change plays at direct opposition to the core of Trump supporters, whose number one issue, according to polls, is electing conservative judges to higher courts. And Biden is not looking to do anything that could play into Trump's talking points or rally his base. So essentially, a lot is on the table. When the minority is able to hold a country hostage, it is no longer a democratic process. It is a constitutional crisis. And if one side refuses to compromise, then it is only natural for the other side, in turn, to adapt to try to survive. This isn't the ideal endgame. It's just the necessary actions to restabilize a crumbling infrastructure. We've said it before, and we'll say it again. The only way to institute change is to exercise your right to vote. Stay tuned for our interview with history teacher Caroline English. All right, so for today's interview, we have Caroline English, and she is a teacher based in Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
Thanks so much, Claire. This is, I think, why I teach. It's really exciting to get to reconnect with former students, and doing so over a podcast is my first time, so I'm super excited.
Well, welcome. We're super excited to have you here. I love having former teachers of mine on the show, just because, yeah, it is a cool way to reconnect and also share all of your wealth of knowledge with our listeners. So to get us started, could you give me just a little bit about your background and maybe how you got into history and teaching in general?
Sure. So I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and I would say, you know, my family is very much like pro-education, pro-books. I read a lot, was always eager to go to school. And they're also, my parents are big into travel, and as well as my grandparents. So whether it was like local field trips or actually, we journeyed to Williamsburg quite a bit. My grandparents are maybe weirdly obsessed with it. So I think that kind of struck this love of history and older times that just meant that it was a subject in school that I always enjoyed. I think English, you know, still being in the humanities is a bit too much about what I felt and thought about things. So I liked that history felt more objective, at least as a younger student. I obviously now know it can be quite subjective and love empowering students to make their own arguments about it, or heck, be opinionated, as we can see.
That's amazing.
So I went on to college and majored in history. I would say my parents were probably a little less excited about that, but I don't know that I'd given too much thought into a career and just thought about what I loved. And upon graduation, actually went into a financial consulting profession right before the 2008 collapse, which prompted me to have to find a new career track and job. And at that point I was like, okay, I've tried this financial stuff for, 4 months. It was a great opportunity, but I think I want to work in schools. And so that's where I was connected to the school you graduated from and had the opportunity to connect with you, Claire.
Yeah.
And I've stuck with teaching ever since. There's definitely no turning back. It's been a great fit. And since then, I've gone on to get my master's in education. So that's sort of been my history knowledge now, just comes from empowering like colleagues who encourage me to like read different articles or books. And then, you know, what I find on the news, on the internet, podcasts, and I think just various time periods I get into. Different phases.
Yeah. This might be a little bit of a different question, but have you noticed teaching history changing over the last few years and adjusting that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say the bigger change has been an increase in students feeling like it's actually essential that they learn about U.S. history. It just so happened that's the field that I've been teaching for the past 11 years. My first year was more world. And I would say around, you know, 2015, 2016, as politics became a heightened topic, things that were students were hearing more so around the dinner table, starting to see on social media, there's just been a bit more focus, or students are more likely to be the ones to connect what we're learning about in class to current events, which is great. It's all just added to, you know, a positive learning environment. We certainly can get into some good debates. I think students are still reticent to have a like head-to-head debate with their peers in front of me. I'm sure some of that's what's happening behind the scenes or on social media, but there's been just more energy around U.S. history.
And connecting, you know, history to current events. Today we're talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Supreme Court and her legacy. I know the school year has kind of just started, but what are your thoughts about the Supreme Court and Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy, just to get us started on that?
I mean, I was really impressed to hear President Trump actually have his opening words sort of sound speechless about her and get into this idea that she's an icon, she was a legend. That's absolutely where my mindset comes from. I have always revered the court. I wouldn't say I really like understood quite what they did until I was older. And then through my study of U.S. history with my students over the past 12 years, like that has, it's been the thing that's emerged as, in my opinion, the most important entity. I've always, you know, I've, let's go back to like 2016 when you started to hear people say like they didn't like their option, so they weren't going to vote. I usually retorted with this idea that, you know, even if you don't like either candidate, they have the ability to nominate justices. And so you should vote based on your political or social beliefs for that reason alone. You know, the candidate may or may not be gone within 4 years, and the people they appoint are on there for life. And I've just seen that as someone who really feels strongly about, you know, positive social change and redefining, like, you know, what it means to be an American and who has access to these rights that we proclaim are for everyone, that the changes to me that seem to stick in a way that lead to people like actually getting to go vote in the 1960s, or, you know, students integrating schools and such, comes from the courts, the federal courts, and they're all important. And then of course the Supreme Court's at the very top. So it's kind of like that. And then economics are two trends I've seen throughout U.S. history that seem to be really, really important. And so when you talk about these justices who are appointed for life, and then they live into that, I mean, that, right? That's a job where you're appointed for life. You are a public figure where it's would be extremely taboo to be seen doing anything non, I almost want to say non-regal, because I actually think the justices get treated a bit more like the monarchies we see in Europe than our presidents. Our presidential candidates have survived all kinds of, what's the word I'm looking for? All kinds of, not drama, but all kinds of scandals. And that's so much more rare for the justices, because they're typically pretty old. They have to be vetted so well. And it's, I mean, they uphold this code where they're not allowed to really be heavily partisan or to engage in politics. And they've, you know, tend to stick by that even when we're in our most partisan moments. They're not, I mean, I think they engage in social life in DC, but you don't see them make the news. They just, it's, and the, their job is so laborious. Like they are working and reading. And, you know, of course their clerks are helping them, but they're not just relying on their ability. Mm-hmm. So for anyone who's lived that role, much less, you know, this woman's the second person who is a woman to serve on the court. You know, I think you have to respect that legacy. And certainly she was someone who used her seat to be vocal, whether it was like offering up dissenting opinions, you know, even if she wasn't going to be in the majority. And she did create a voice for herself. Yeah. And then of course, we also have like her social media presence that popped up, not because of her, but because of her followers, which has been so fun in the past couple of years.
I know, it's so funny whenever I go into like little gift stores around town, they have, you know, little knickknacks and stuff, and they have those like prayer candles that have pictures of like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or, you know, like the enamel pins that say like Notorious RBG, exactly. And things like that. Yeah, she really has become like an American icon. And it's so interesting you say the monarchy too, because they really do have a very different way they are presented and present themselves. And I didn't really think about that. Like, you know, growing up in the DC area, you would be like, oh, you know, this person was spotted, like this congressman or whatever. But yeah, I never really ever heard anything about the justices at all, like their outings or anything.
Yeah, and actually this information I've only picked up, I think being at a school so close to DC, we've got some really great connections. And I've been able to go with a government class to sit, and actually Justice Roberts, you know, was able, he came and spoke to the class I was with.
Wow.
And a lot of that information he shared to us about, you know, what they view as acceptable and unacceptable. And then you can also go on a tour of the Supreme Court. And I want to say I did that with the National Council for Social Studies. Yeah, they had a detailed tour, and the docent got into some of the behind the scenes things we wouldn't have known otherwise. So for example, they have a gym on the upper level of the Supreme Court that we got to go tour, which is pretty basic and old school looking, but fun to hear that that's an option. And of course, I think, you know, those are some of the things that we, since RBG had this lifestyle that could be emulated, and we started to see and learn about her public or private life through, you know, the documentaries that were coming out. I think it's been fun. People really latched on to her fitness regimen. And then, you know, many of you may have seen or heard that her fitness trainer was at her funeral, like, and did some push-ups in her honor, which is just, I mean, I think how could anyone not like that?
Yeah.
This woman, yeah.
I couldn't even imagine what that would be like to see, like, you know, your person that you're training pass away. That just feels so like sad, but.
Absolutely. I think that relationship is where you see that these justices are put up on a pedestal, but yet they do have, you know, common everyday connections with people.
Yeah. And kind of speaking of that, I hadn't included this question, but I know that RBG had a past relationship with, or friendship with Antonin Scalia. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, that like liberal versus conservative, you know, kind of what that friendship could maybe be like? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's something that Chief Justice Roberts shared with us as well. And I mean, I think he was so in awe of it that these two individuals could think so differently about the Constitution, about politics, and yet, you know, push that aside and go, I want to say I'm forgetting what they did together. Like if they were big theater goers, or maybe Sotomayor is a big theater goer. I forgot kind of what their little hobbies were. Another thing that Chief Justice Roberts shared is that, if I'm not mistaken, all the justices eat lunch together. Like that's just something that if they're in session, they put aside their different, like their work, and make sure to gather. And I think those are the moments that you, again, you're realizing their humanity. And today, when we don't have many examples of people across the aisles who are best friends or even married to each other or whatnot, I think that's why their friendship's being held up so highly. And it was really powerful, right? So when Scalia died, we heard from RBG about him. And now with her passing, to see Scalia's family actually speak up about her when things are extra tension-oriented pre-election, I found to be really powerful. And what a good model, right? We are typically seeing people consume news from sources they tend to like, where they lean. Mm-hmm. And to actually have a friend that is a deep, close connection is probably something we should all do, just to better our own thought processes and, empathy.
Yeah, that is something that, being an artist and being in an artistic community, I feel like a lot of my social media is very much into a void. And so that's something I'm personally working on, is being like, how can I, engage with someone who maybe I don't agree with? Besides if someone is, bigoted and hateful, that's a different category.
I will say, so in attempting to kind of like walk the talk,
yeah,
with her passing that evening, I think I, started reading something in the New York Times app that I have. And then I was wondering, what is Breitbart saying right now? Mm-hmm. And so I went to their website and they had posted an obituary that was honestly like quite lovely. There was maybe a sentence or two where I sort of was, I wonder what, I don't think a different account would have said it that way. But I think that's part of her power too, is that at least, we've started to see, of course, the aftermath of her passing.
Yeah.
But when you talk about her, there's tends to be nothing but respect, mm-hmm, from all sides.
And that's really important too, because she really changed the game on a lot of gender issues and, on the basis of sex, that movie that came out about her, and things along those lines. But kind of speaking of across the aisle, different perspectives, her seat is now open. If you'd like to touch on what your opinion is about confirming a new justice in an election year, the precedent of that, how it's been handled in the past, just sort of like what this historical moment means.
Sure. It's interesting because what I would want to happen isn't necessarily what is like legal to have happen. Mm-hmm. So, I've relied on news sources that have been investigating kind of like, what are the options? Mm-hmm. If you are liberal minded, if you're a Democrat, whatever the case may be. And at the end of the day, there is plenty of time for her to be appointed. Her being, Amy Coney Barrett. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't actually be rushing things necessarily. I want to say I saw an average of like 42 days or something for justices to be confirmed. Mm-hmm. And there's far more days than that left before this Congress finishes their session in December. So, that's tough news, yeah, for some of us, depending on what side of the political aisle you're on. Mm-hmm. It is extra frustrating that in 2016, we can see individuals in Congress who said, we should wait till the election has come. And now they've backtracked on those words and are acknowledging it's a different time.
Yeah,
it is. I do think the big difference that we need to recognize is, while the political party of the president may be opposite of the political leaning of the justice who's passed, mm-hmm, the big difference is that in both cases, like who's been controlling Congress and the Senate in particular, mm-hmm, which again, I would just say goes to show every vote matters. We tend to love to focus on presidents in our country. There's nothing wrong with that, but we need to remember that every appointed elected official matters. So it sucks, but at the end of the day, this is totally legal. Mm-hmm. And while you could argue that some should wait until the election passes, and absolutely that's her dying wish, as per the system, Republicans do not need to wait. It might be nice for the election to pass, and you'd have to wonder if Democrats were in the same situation, would they wait?
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm not one to critique President Obama, but, I found myself, if I'm really being honest, thinking like, wow, what could have been done differently to push through a justice upon Scalia's death? because maybe one of the takeaways is that air of stability isn't quite here right now, and you need to go with what you have from an election perspective. That said, you know, he didn't have the Congress on his side, so we don't necessarily know if that would have even been possible. So of course it's frustrating to have this happen, and it's fairly unprecedented. I was talking with my colleague, he's more of the academic than I am. I'm more the pop culture person, about, you know, when's the last time that it's been so threatening that we would actually see a shift in the number of justices from a liberal versus conservative side.
Yeah.
And he like really couldn't come up with anything, and I couldn't either. And I think you're starting to maybe read about it in like 1932 or so. That's what feels, I think, a little extra threatening right now, is that we could see an actual tip in this in the scales. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
So, and it does mean that it could have a long-term effect. November matters from that perspective, and trying to, you know, keep the party in office that you wouldn't want to replace any future seats. Mm-hmm.
That is something that I was doing a little bit of research on, about what's the term, where they like pack the court, and
yes,
sort of learning about how every politician throughout history that I'm learning about had some sort of agenda and some sort of angle, no matter how good or, you know, well respected or revered they are, which is really interesting. And also makes me kind of, similar to what you were saying, really think about what I would want. You know, if the Democrats had been able to push through on a seat, like would have that made me feel good? And like, is Trump just doing something bad because I don't agree with him? And it really, that's part of this show too, is like, really figuring out where the facts are and what your opinions are, and kind of melding the two and not realizing that your opinions are facts.
And I think, or they're straight up opinions.
Yeah.
You know, I think, and that's the one here. I mean, this news is actually devastating, because if you are hoping the court can be a place for progressive decisions,
yeah,
right? If you want to see more along the lines of same-sex marriage, and, you know, women having the ability to hold, have credit cards, get mortgages, things that like RBG signed off on. And there's so many significant social issues right now. Like, we are in a wave of social justice,
yeah,
akin to the 60s, akin to the like early 1900s. And to actually almost have this seat where you can shift that power in the court and have it almost ripped out from under you is devastating.
Yeah.
And it's hard, I think, for people who think that way to realize that half of America, and maybe not quite half, is actually equally excited about the ability to shift the power towards more conservative social thought. And I think it's the social issues that are bubbling up so important right now for people. Republicans who vote on more of an economic level don't seem to me as excited about the potential for this vacancy to be filled on their side. It's probably still very important for economic decisions, right? We've got the healthcare reform coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because we're living through such a remarkable social era that's why this feels even more important.
Yeah, I agree too. And even thinking about, you know, learning about Justice Ginsburg, you know, being able, a woman being able to have a credit card and have a mortgage and buy a car and things like that. And, you know, I think about my mom, and like, my mom was in college in the 70s. And like, that is crazy to me to think, you know, she's, you know, this age that is similar to I am now, and not being able to have a credit card and like learning and gaining those access to those things. And so I'm very, you know, I feel it now. Like, I feel it in my own personal life, her effects, RBG's effects, that is.
Right. And mm-hmm. I think it is threatening to imagine some of those could be taken away,
yeah,
right? And like, obviously it's in no one's interest, like, and by no one I mean banks, mm-hmm, to like not let women have credit cards now. Or maybe it is, because we probably pay them off better. But, you know, abortion's obviously been brought up right now. I got to admit that deep down, I would be shocked to see it actually overturned on a federal level.
Yeah,
it can be interesting to see it come up and decide what happens. And maybe it's more that they're pushing it to the state. They see it as not explicitly written as a federal power. And of course, that's right. When we say conservative, sometimes that's what we mean. They're actually like reading the constitution from the
like the original
original doctrine versus you know, if we want to say, oh well, okay, here's what it would look like in 2020 if we mm-hmm. interpret it that way. But I mean, it possibly is something that could happen. I listened to a really upsetting podcast from The Daily. I think it was from The Daily about a women's organization that is actively pushing to put you know, anti-abortion justices in line, or just politicians who will side with anti-abortionists. I mean, our whole lives, right? Like your life, my life, that's been an option. It's unreal to think that can be taken off the table. And it's infuriating to think that a court that's still largely dominated by men, if it's a man appointing this woman, like just anyone other than myself can tell me what I want to do with my body. Mm-hmm. And I have nothing against organizations trying to influence that opinion. But it's a whole nother story to say they would actually be the ones to make laws inhibiting what I can do with my body. And then history has shown, right, that like women will continue to get abortions. They just won't be safe. And that's really sad. So that feels heightened and something that we know, while it's been a bit conflated about like how, you know, and people have gotten into Justice Ginsburg's actual thoughts on that decision. But I think the conflation of her with that in that pro-abortion standpoint is actually more this idea of like who's in control of the court, and is Justice Roberts a swing vote, or is he now viewed as like a potential, like to help more liberal justices like lock in, even beginning to try to get a majority.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely been a critique of Coney Barrett's appointment, would be that she is so young and has some of these more conservative social views that she could have some very long-term lasting decisions that could, you know, expand over 40 years if she is confirmed and appointed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, you know, that's just, it's just so important to vote no matter what you think is going to happen. Right. Yeah. And, you know, we can get into all like voter law rules, things like that. You also have to start, I start wondering, like, or thinking back to like 2016, like so much was assumed about what was going to happen in that election.
Yeah.
Did President Obama hold back from pushing through an appointment because of what we thought was going to happen by the polls, you know, public opinion polls? Did that mean that certain justices, you know, would have retired otherwise and didn't? Because why not serve if you are feeling up to it? And just remembering, you know, every 4 years, we have no actual guarantee on the future. And so I think we'll start to see, and I would wonder if we'd start to see justices looking to retire when they know who's in power. And then maybe not, though. Maybe that's the cool part, where they just love their job and are so dedicated to it that they serve it till the end of time. Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of young justices who are quite conservative right now. So that's, they're probably not going anywhere. It's true.
Probably not. They are most likely not, which is scary. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but is something that maybe I don't personally agree with. And like you're saying, every vote does matter. And, you know, voting for your circuit judges, like that is something that indirectly/directly would affect the Supreme Court maybe someday.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, because, you know, what are those justices ruling on in terms of redistricting mm-hmm. cases and such? You know, there's just all this trickle-down effect.
Yeah. Well, Caroline, thank you so much for coming on Sit Still, Look Opinionated. If our listeners wanted to maybe learn a little bit more about the Supreme Court, or just about court workings in general, or maybe RBG, where would you point them?
Yeah, okay. I think I would have to say, if you haven't seen any of the documentaries that came out recently, they're great watches. Mm-hmm. Turn it on, heck, and make yourself dinner or something. You don't have to watch it. It could be a nice way to get some more facts than what I probably had to share. Oyez is a really cool app that you can throw on your phone in case court cases pop up and you're wondering. I mean, Wikipedia is great too, obviously, for a little rundown. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of an official one.
What is it? Oyez?
Oyez, O-Y-E-Z.
I have not heard of it. I'll have to look into that.
Also, if you are in D.C. and we get through this pandemic, go hear a case. It is so cool. They will let public in. It tends to be first come, first serve. If it's a really popular case, that's way harder. I've gotten to hear like two cases. One of them was so nuanced, I didn't really know what was happening and had to go look at my app afterwards. But to see at that point, the nine of them sit and deliberate and ask questions, it's powerful. And it's, again, open to the public. Follow Nina Totenberg. She's NPR's correspondent who's been covering the Supreme Court since before I was born. So I'd like to think that she knows a good bit more there. And so her articles to me have like a little extra oomph than whatever I go pick up in some other news source. I do think it's good to see what other news sources are saying from across the aisle. And then, you know, so many podcasts have been covering this topic recently that if you just go search what they've had to say, like I said, there are a couple of interesting ones coming out of the Daily from the New York Times. That have been informative, in my opinion.
Those are great. Yeah, I'll definitely have to check out that app. And yeah, I always forget that in DC, you really can go do a lot of things. You just kind of have to scratch the surface a little bit.
And maybe so, wake up early.
Yeah.
Beat some traffic. We've had students actually sleep over and camp out outside the court in order to get into certain cases with their teacher. So.
Oh my gosh. That's cool. So cool. That's so cool. Well, great. Thank you so much. And that's today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.